Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, December 15th, 2014. Will former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman be home for the holidays?
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. 'Cause no matter how far away you roam, if you want to be happy in a million ways, for the holidays, you can't beat home, sweet home.
Take a bus, take a train, go and hop an aeroplane, put the wife and kiddies in the family car.
Well, Don Siegelman did take a bus, he did take a plane. It was a grueling trip from Oakdale, Louisiana, to the courtroom in Alabama for a hearing held about 10:30 a.m. local time today. And Don Siegelman, as you know if you're a regular listener to this podcast, was railroaded into federal prison by a group of schemers, up to and including Karl Rove. And he is still paying a price for the lack of justice in the state of Alabama. But there's a new judge on the case because Mark Fuller, who presided over the railroading of Don Siegelman, is busy defending himself from charges of domestic violence and alcoholism and possible drug usage. And so a new judge brought in from district court in Georgia, his name is Clay Land, held a hearing, and I'm looking at a news account from Alabama.com. And the headline reads, "Former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman could soon be released from prison." The judge did not issue a decision from the bench, but promised to do so by the end of this week. And based on the arguments advanced by former White House counsel Greg Craig, now the lead attorney for Don Siegelman's appeals, seemed to score some points with this new judge. He also allowed in his own commentary that there are structural issues related to the convictions that Don Siegelman has been busy appealing. Now, one of the central points that Greg Craig told Judge Land is that Laura Canary, the wife of Bill Canary, business partner of one Karl Rove, who Karl got appointed, Laura, to U.S. attorney in Alabama, that she claimed to have recused herself but continued to be involved in the case. And that's just one of the issues that is before the appeals court. So we don't have a decision today, but I take it as encouraging that the judge held a hearing, asked a lot of questions, listened to what the attorneys for Siegelman had to say, seemed to challenge some of the government positions. And there is an appeals hearing scheduled for January in Atlanta, I believe. And so with that in mind, Siegelman has requested bail. We'll see if this new judge, Clay Land, is feeling compassionate here at the holiday season. And our friend and colleague Roger Shuler, who paid quite a price for his blogging coverage of the Siegelman affair and related corruption in the courts and politics of Alabama. He posted an item at Legal Schnauzer on Sunday that is kind of a draft that Judge Clay Land could easily have used and still could use when he writes his decision later this week. And let me read a couple of lines from it. This, again, is Roger Shuler saying what the judge should put into his decision. "Governor Siegelman, the record shows that you and your co-defendant Richard Scrushy have been through a nightmare, one that should never happen on American soil. You have served years in federal custody for crimes you didn't commit. The record is filled with juror misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, including coaching and threatening a key witness, failure to turn over potentially exculpatory evidence, and dubious rulings from the bench by a man we now know has serious problems with alcohol and prescription painkillers. On top of that, there was insufficient evidence to convict, in part because a check that Scrushy allegedly handed to you, which the government contends was a corrupt deal, had not been written at the time witness Nick Bailey said the transaction took place. My number one concern, however, is that by law, you and Scrushy never should have gone to trial. The government wrote an indictment that was so vague that the defendants hardly knew what they were defending themselves against. And when you asked for a bill of particulars from the government, the trial judge denied the request. Schuler goes on. It wasn't until deep into your trial that it became evident the alleged unlawful conduct took place in the summer of 1999, and the indictment was issued May 17, 2005. 6 full years had elapsed, meaning the charges were brought well after the 5-year statute of limitations. Well, Roger Schuler, I hope that at least parts of your draft are picked up by Judge Clay Land. Later today, I'll be recording an interview with the governor of, the daughter of Governor Siegelman, Dana Siegelman, and we'll get her reaction to the proceedings in the court today. Another critical case that we are watching may come to a showdown in a courtroom tomorrow. And this is the case where the U.S. Department of Justice has been trying to force New York Times reporter James Risen to name a source and testify against him. Risen has promised he will not do so. On 60 Minutes recently, he said, "The choice the government has given me is give up everything I believe in or go to jail. So I'm not going to talk," says Risen. Now, late on Friday, when the news breaks that they don't want you to know about, a leak, and this is really fascinating, all right, because Risen is being prosecuted in violation of the First Amendment, trying to force him to reveal a confidential source. And so an anonymous source from the Justice Department, described as a senior justice official, and that could be Eric Holder, may not be, but it could be, that's the code that is often used to describe a cabinet-level officer. Well, a senior Justice Department official, late on Friday, indicated that Risen would not be asked to name his source, but might still be subpoenaed to answer questions about other matters. Now, late on Friday, I got a celebratory? How do you like that one? An enthusiastic email from Norman Solomon, who collected signatures, thousands of them, on behalf of James Risen. And he was saying that this is a signal that the government has given up trying to compel Risen to testify. But the New York Times' own reporting on this in the Sunday paper leaves it a little less explicit. And that, of course, is because we're basing it on this anonymous source. There's no official statement from the Justice Department about this. So we'll be watching that one carefully. Fingers crossed that James Risen prevails. Over the weekend, the Senate completed the dirty work started by the House of Representatives last week on that $1.1 trillion cram-down, what is it called, the Continuing Resolution Omnibus Bill. Cromnibus is the handle for it. And it's ugly in so many respects. And first and foremost, it's an indictment of the way our legislative process works or fails to work in this era. And the stinky stuff that was added to this bill that was never introduced by a regular member of the House or the Senate, that was never heard in a committee hearing, never voted on until this huge package was dropped on the legislators last week. Well, it's got a bunch of favorite little, how do I describe them? These are not really significant policy measures in some respects. For example, on school lunches, the Republicans simply wanted to tweak Michelle Obama for her work, which I applaud her for, trying to send messages to people to eat more healthy food and to get more exercise. And so to tweak her, they eased rules requiring more whole grains in school lunches. And it suspends the lower sodium standards due to take effect in 2017. What kind of bullshit is it when Congress dictates what can or can't be on the menu in a school lunch? That's micromanaging from the less government people, right? Then there's the one about traditional light bulbs, the incandescent kind. You know, for years we've been trying to phase them out. for energy efficiency reasons primarily. But that's not popular with Republicans. So the less government crew insisted on rules that make it harder to, eliminate these incandescent light bulbs. Then there's a mixed bag for pot smokers. It's good news that the bill blocks the Justice Department from raiding medical marijuana dispensaries in states like California that permit them, where during the first few years of Obama's presidency, they held back. It was kind of an unofficial amnesty. And then, as the 2012 election cycle loomed, justice started cracking down on legal medical pot dispensaries here in California. But in the same inhale, the bill blocks federal and local spending to legalize marijuana in Washington, where voters approved recreational use in November. Once again, the less government team micromanaging a decision made at the local level in Washington, D.C., which should not be a fiefdom of the Congress, but it is. And then there are the more significant issues, like the insertion at the last minute of this item that increases by a factor of 10 the amount of money that rich people can contribute to the political parties. The New York Times had a pretty good backgrounder on this over the weekend, showing how this whole idea originated with John Boehner, who was looking for a way to pay for the upcoming presidential nominating convention in Cleveland in 2016. And they wanted to be able to open the gates to allow more big money from rich fat cats to flow directly into the political parties. Now, this unravels the historic McCain-Feingold restrictions on soft money that went into effect, I think, in 2002. Now, before you just say, "Oh, that evil John Boehner," Harry Reid took a look at this and said, "Well, we can do some business with you, John." Because it turns out that the Democratic National Committee owes almost $6 million on a mortgage on some office space in Washington, D.C., and they've been looking for a way to pay that off without having to raise the money from hundreds, if not thousands, of people. They wanted to find one rich MF and get him or her to write the check. So voila, we have a deal. And Harry Reid called in his favorite election lawyer, and the Republicans called in theirs, Ben Ginsburg. And they cut a deal. And it doesn't matter that it outraged their own members. It certainly doesn't matter that it outrages you and me. Because this is business as usual. We have two corporate political parties in this country, and they simply fight over a little bit of turf where they disagree. In Sydney, Australia, there was a hostage situation that ran for 16 hours. And this is a bizarre one. A self-proclaimed sheikh held as many as 17 people hostage. In the end, police raided this chocolate shop, a Lindt chocolate shop. Two of the hostages were killed, apparently one by the gunman, who also was killed by the police raid. And his name, we have learned, is Mon Haran Monis, an Iranian-born, about 50, with a criminal record. And his criminal record's pretty serious. He's accused of murdering his ex-wife, who was stabbed and set on fire. And in April of this year, he was charged with indecent sexual assault of a woman in Western Sydney in 2002. Now, based on his own website, he has converted, that's the word I'm looking for, from a Shiite version of Islam to Sunni Islam, and his website says that he has very strong sympathy for the Islamic State. He carried one of their black flags, or at least he demanded one. The accounts are a little bit confusing. But he displayed a flag similar to the one used by the Islamic State while he was conducting this hostage event. So it's a very strange one. And my concern for my friendly listeners in Australia, Hamish, Mark the Boat Builder, John out in West Australia, you tell me if this is going to be used as another pretext, a terror event, to roll back more rights of citizens and the media in the nation of Australia. The Supreme Court does not have the courage to take up a case and issue a clear ruling on abortion rights in 2014. But in its own way, today the court did us a favor because it rejected an appeal of a ruling from the Ninth Circuit here in San Francisco, which had overturned an Arizona law which put restrictions on access to medical abortion drugs or abortion-inducing drugs. And the law was passed there in 2012. It requires abortion providers to comply with an FDA regulation from 2000, which is out of date and has potentially deadly effects. In simple terms, the old protocol called for a higher dosage in a shorter period of time, and they now say you can use a lower dose over a longer period of time. And so this is the way the court operates. It's telling Arizona, you passed an unconstitutional law, but rather than rule clearly and in a way that would set precedence nationally, the court takes the easy way out and limits this ruling essentially to the state of Arizona. Over the weekend, they hammered out something that's called a deal in Lima, Peru, related to reducing carbon emissions. And this is setting the table for a conference in Paris next year. But the two-week talks were extended by 2 days amid wrangling, and environmental activists call it an ineffectual compromise, but the spinners say it's a step toward achieving a global climate deal next year in Paris. And the bottom line is that developing nations feel that they should have their turn at burning massive amounts of carbon because we've had ours. And I can understand the rationale for it, or at least the practical motivation for it. But at a certain point, we've got to recognize that we're all going to suffer, if not, you know, end life on the planet at some point, if we don't get this under control. So the agreement says that in 2015, we need an ambitious agreement that reflects differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities of each nation. Developed countries will provide financial support to vulnerable developing nations. That's the proposal. National pledges to reduce carbon will be submitted by the first quarter of next year by those states that are ready to do so. Wow, that's really compelling. Countries will set targets that go beyond their current undertaking. That is a really wimpy standard. And then they're going to report back to us in another year, in November of next year. So, you know, it's very frustrating because I would love to see more movement internationally in addressing climate change, but we simply don't see consensus and a real sense of the threat. Every day I like to pause for a moment and thank the people who support my work on this podcast with your subscriptions. And first and foremost today, we welcome Constance Smith, who signed up for a new annual subscription over the weekend. Constance, your ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's new book called Empire of Chaos will be on its way to you shortly. And thank you for your support. Meanwhile, Joey Perillo is still a monthly subscriber, as is Marianne Razzo and Wendy Gebauer. Thanks to each and every one of you for your support. And if you're not a subscriber, it's easy to do. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the link under my picture that says sign up. There you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers anywhere in the whole damn world qualify for a copy of the ebook bonus gift from Pepe Escobar. Well, the remainder of the podcast I'm going to devote to reaction to last week's Senate Intelligence Committee report, which was partially released, and even the partial release was heavily redacted. And I'm scheduled tomorrow to record an interview. We'll go in-depth with Jason Leopold, the investigative reporter who has been covering Guantanamo, torture, rendition, these issues for many years. It's deeply in his so-called wheelhouse. And just to be candid with you, Jason's been extremely busy. I'll explain why here directly. I tried to get on his schedule for Friday last week, and he had to fly to Florida because he learned that the CIA had lifted parts of its nondisclosure agreement imposed on James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. And to his credit, Leopold was one of the first to track down James Mitchell and interview him. He and Jessen were the architects of the torture program. And in an interview that Leopold conducted with Mitchell over the weekend with new, less restrictive ground rules, he got Mitchell to say, yes, I waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I was part of a larger team that waterboarded a small number of detainees. He also was involved in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah and Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, who was accused of planning the bombings of two American embassies and the USS Cole. Now, it's very interesting because Mitchell, who's not terribly apologetic about what he's done, is nevertheless kind of a loose cannon who says some pretty interesting, if potentially outrageous, things. So he's tired of holding back, and he says, he acknowledges, there were some abuses that occurred at CIA black sites. He says the Senate report says the CIA marginalized and ignored numerous internal critiques, criticisms, and objections concerning the operation of the program. But Mitchell says what it omitted is that he and Jessen were the unnamed interrogators identified in the Senate report who raised many of the concerns about abuses and the use of techniques not authorized by the Justice Department. So this is quite a revelation. And I give Leopold a whole lot of credit for developing this source and getting him to speak. There is a 25-minute video interview of James Mitchell that you can find at news.vice.com, and it's pretty interesting. So, Mitchell, at the same time, explains that it was not necessarily the work that he had done on helping train Air Force members to resist torture and extreme interrogation, but he was first called in to analyze a document called the Manchester Report, the Manchester Manual, that cops in England found on a computer in 2000 at the home of an alleged Al-Qaeda suspect. And so that's a very interesting development that differs from what we had known before. So anyway, Mitchell says, I had a contract with a department at the CIA, and I happened to be in the building at Langley. And in 2002, I was asked by a person who knew me and my background to take a look at the manual, review the resistance techniques, and provide descriptions of what the detainees' behavior would look like during the interrogations if they deployed those techniques. So that's a very interesting change to some of the news or assumptions that we had about that. And also, Mitchell explains more of his history to Jason Leopold in Vice News. He said Mitchell provided voluminous military evaluation records going back decades to show that he has an extensive background in special operations, hostage negotiations, and interrogation training, and that he's provided classified briefings to the CIA, the FBI, and NSA. So Mitchell very clearly wants to, you know, clear up misconceptions he thinks are out there about him. But Leopold got him to talk in detail about the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And he said that, you know, the 183 times that we hear about was actually 183 pours of water that lasted between 1 and 10 seconds. Now keep in mind, this is uncorroborated statement from one of the principals of the torture and interrogation program. So he does in this way minimize the count of the number of times that KSM was waterboarded, and it makes it seem like, oh, you make him feel like he's drowning for a little while, and then you let him breathe, and then you do it again. It doesn't minimize it to me, but that appears to be his goal. And the other claim from Mitchell is, quote, I was told that President George W. Bush had authorized my action. I was told that the highest law enforcement office in the land had judged those actions to be legal. I was told that the intelligence committees in Congress had been briefed. And now I'm being denigrated by some of the very people who pushed me to use harsher measures. So often this kind of disagreement between people like Jim Mitchell, James Mitchell, and, Dick Cheney, who we'll get to later, this is often what provokes the real truth to surface. And perhaps we'll see that. Now, speaking of Mitchell and Jessen, there's an interesting profile of a CIA interrogator named Glenn Carl, written by Kevin Mullen, that appears in Sunday's Boston Globe. And in particular, Glenn Carl has it in for Mitchell and Jessen. Carl says James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, the two psychologists hired to justify the torture methods, euphemistically referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques, or EITs, were quacks pushing unproven theories. Quote, everybody in the CIA knew these guys were frauds. They had never done intelligence work. They had never done interrogations. Our government paid them $81 million, and they gave the agency the cover the White House thought it needed. Well, that's quite an indictment. Coming from a CIA agent who says he refused to cross the line and torture. And Glenn Carl also goes after John Yoo, who basically said you can do whatever you want as long as you don't kill them. We'll mention John Yoo again in a moment here. I will link to virtually all of these torture articles that I'm referencing in the show file for this podcast, and I invite you to peruse them when you have the time. So John Yoo was making the rounds of Sunday talk shows, was on with Fareed Zakaria on CNN, also made an appearance on C-SPAN. And he said that the sleep deprivation, rectal feeding, and other harsh treatment outlined in the Senate report could violate anti-torture laws. If these things happened, he said, as they're described in the report, they were not supposed to be done, and the people who did those are at risk legally because they were acting outside their orders. So that's kind of interesting. Now, John Yoo attacks the report using the same talking points that Dick Cheney uses and all the other Republican apologists, and even some Democrats. But he says, looking at it now, you can do these things cumulatively or too much that it would cross the line of the anti-torture statute. So even John Yoo is walking back some of his extremely broad legal opinions that were used to, to redefine torture so that we could torture people and Bush could say we don't. That's my interpretation of it. I want to commend to you an analytical piece by Sam Husseini that was published at Common Dreams on Friday. And Sam Husseini is an interesting guy. He is one of the people who runs the Institute for Public Accuracy. He spends most of his time trying to get progressives covered in the media. And so I was very pleased to see him write in his own voice. He says, what both sides are ignoring is that torture did work. And his idea of how it worked is very different from what you hear from, John Brennan, the CIA director, or good old Dick Cheney. So Husseini writes, on one side we have among others Dianne Feinstein and John McCain. Then on the other side, we have six former directors and deputy directors of CIA claiming the interrogation program saved thousands of lives by helping to capture Al-Qaeda members. And he says, well, you know, they're both claiming that it worked and it didn't work. But the way it actually worked, he says the truth is the torture did work and not the way its defenders claim. It worked to produce justifications for policies the establishment wanted, like the Iraq War. This is actually tacitly acknowledged in the report, or buried in it in footnote 857, talking about Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, who was captured in Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion, interrogated by the FBI, and then the CIA sent him to Egypt, where we're told that Omar Suleiman, the head of the Mukhabarat, the guy who Hillary Clinton thought would be a good successor to Mubarak, Suleiman personally was involved in the torture of al-Libi. And, while tortured, he offered information, it turned out he recanted it later, that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq. And so Sam Husseini makes some really cogent points. I hope you'll take a look at his commentary. And finally, we'll get to Mr. Darkside himself, Dick Cheney, who crawled out of wherever he spends his time to make the rounds, and he was on NBC's Meet the Press. And I'm going to link to PolitiFact, which is a project of a newspaper in Florida that tries to evaluate statements of public officials and rate them true or false, or mostly true or mostly false. And in a lengthy dissemination of Dick Cheney's remarks, where he acknowledged that he hasn't even read the report, which certainly makes him an expert when he says it's full of crap. But, you know, Chuck Todd kept listing some of the torture methods that were used and asked Cheney if they were torture. You know, like these enema acts, rectal rehydration, they call it. And, of course, Cheney is full of bluster, and he repeats some of the old disproven bullshit about this clearly false suggestion that there was a link between Saddam and al-Qaeda. And PolitiFact rates his claim absolutely false. It then goes on to look at some of the other statements that he made. And I encourage you to take a look at this, including Cheney saying that the terrorists were not covered by the Geneva Convention. It's not really true, and PolitiFact rates it as mostly false. One other reaction to Cheney's comments comes from the New York Times and Juliet Lapidos. She writes, in a disturbing interview on Meet the Press, former Vice President Dick Cheney basically taunted ambitious lawyers at The Hague to come after him, and unintentionally made the case for why President Obama was wrong to not look back upon assuming power. And she lists some of his statements, and sums it up by saying Mr. Cheney was bullishly nonsensical. Does he not acknowledge a difference between mass murder and torture? Worse, he was unrepentant. Did any of the details from the report plant any seed of doubt, asked Todd of Cheney? Absolutely not, says the Dick. What about the fact that 25% of the detainees turned out to be innocent? Well, I have no problem as long as we achieve our objective, answered Cheney, to get the guys who did 9/11. I'll tell you, the power of rationalization in the minds of warmongers and chicken hawks like Dick Cheney never ceases to amaze me. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everyone, and I certainly hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. happy trails to you. Keep smiling.